Hi, everybody. My name's John Evans. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John. We love you, John. Lots and lots and lots. How much?
There we go. Thank you very much. The last time I was welcomed like that, it cost me $250. So I'm glad to be here with you. So I've been sober by the grace of God and through sponsorship and fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous since August 13th of 1989, and I'm very grateful for that. That's how they do it where I'm from. I'm from Omaha, a little suburb called Bellevue in Nebraska, And I was completely unimpressed when people introduced themselves because nobody stays sober longer than a few months. And if I was stupid enough to do that, I wasn't going to brag about it. And I just, you know, basically I hate anybody that has something I want and can't have. So I hated all of you, especially the guys that had female companionship because I was very lonely. And I know. Before I get going, I always have to have a card so I don't forget my manners because I don't know if you can relate. I'm very self-centered, and and it's always a little spooky getting up here. And so I get up here and I get even more self-centered. And so thank you, Jessica. Thanks for calling and inviting me, and the committee for putting this on. It's a lot of work. I was actually on the Cornhusker committee for 10 years, and it's a lot of work being on a committee. If you like everybody in AA, get on a committee. Because it can be challenging. My sponsor was on the committee, and that helped me develop relationships with some other men I can talk to, because sometimes I wasn't happy with him, because he's not as good a committee member as I am. But, you know, it's just, that's the nature of that stuff. It's just tough stuff, very rewarding, but tough. And thank you all, whoever was on the committee. Thanks for having us. This is just a wonderful weekend. And I want to thank Dave, our taper. A thankless gig, and it's an important gig. Well, I don't know about you, but when I was new, I'm young, and we had tapes then, cassette tapes, and that was most of the first 6 years of my sobriety. My job, I disappeared a lot. No contact, no communication, couldn't talk about what I did, and that was my connection. I had a big book and, you know, tapes. That was all I had, and it was very helpful because I can get in my head a lot, and I've always got a flash drive or something in my car so I can listen to something other than the hum of my own self-awareness. So I'm really glad to get to be here with you guys today. I am, I grew up in Illinois, Southern Illinois, in the 70s, and you know, I was never right. I never fit in. I had all the ism as far back as I can remember. I learned that in inventory. And in studying our literature, I've always suffered from the ism. And then I had an uncle who owned a bar. He was my favorite uncle. I wonder why. And I remember I was 5 years old, and I got to I would always go and clean the glasses because they had like the sinks with the spinny brushes in them, and I'd clean glasses, and the old guys would give me some of their change sometimes, and I could play the pinball machine, and they let me have two glasses of beer, and it was I didn't know then. It was just like, wow, you know, hey, I like the taste of everything except for gin, but I'll drink it. but I just everything clicked. It was just wonderful. I didn't realize then how big of a deal it was, but, you know, in inventory and looking back at that, it felt like I was in the Wizard of Oz. It felt like, you know, the house just landed. I came out and I'm like, holy crap color. And I'm the tallest guy in the room, and it was just, everything was great. And I didn't realize how wrong my life was until I found alcohol. And I didn't know it at the time, but I spent the next however many years, 15 years, drinking as often as I could, as much as I could, whenever I could, whatever I could get my hands on. I learned how to strain cigarette butts out of leftover drinks. I learned how to do, you know, it also works for glass if you find a broken bottle. I used to dumpster dive at my uncle's bar, and you find a broken bottle with a little bit of alcohol in the bottom. You just, you know, you strain it and drink the alcohol. Make sure you don't swallow some glass. And if I didn't have a strainer, you just say a quick prayer and chug it down. But I didn't know anything was wrong with that. I grew up in a very wet county. I grew up to two parents that were married 38 years and loved each other. They showed us and taught us and told us what love was. They taught us right from wrong. I got an older sister who became a lot less of a bitch after I sobered up, and a younger brother. And my sister told me I was special for 30 years before I realized it wasn't a compliment. I mean, she was a good older sister, but we had a great family. I grew up in a small town, and you could ride your bike all around, and you know, they would test the tornado/fire siren at 6 p.m. every night. We called it the supper whistle. That means it's time to get the hell home, because if you ain't home by the time the whistle's done doing its thing, you're in some trouble, and life was just good. So I can't blame them about my alcoholism, unfortunately. But I, a really wet county, so we just, you drink, right? You roam and you drink and you go to school and you do those things. I became an altar boy. I went to Catholic school for 12 years, and because they made me. And second grade, I was an altar boy. I usually had to be in the third grade, but they let me do it. I just couldn't wait. And then I loved it. I would help clean up afterwards and go find the communion, not the stuff that had already been blessed. I ain't stupid, but you got to get the stuff you're not going to hell for. Have a little snack, get the church wine, go to second grade. You know, it was beautiful, just beautiful. And I volunteered all the time to be one of the servers. We had mass at 8 a.m. every morning. And later they wanted me to become a priest because I was so devoted to the cause. And and I was all in until I looked up the word celibacy. And I hadn't had sex yet with anyone other than myself, but I figured it was probably only going to get better. And the priesthood just wasn't for me. And so also I had discovered where they kept the collection money, which is a whole night step story. By the way, if you are new or not so new, or as you have kids, I can tell you two alcoholics don't make a non-alcoholic generally. So teach your kids about the night step early. It'll save them some financial amends later. I would have stole a lot less if I'd have known, allegedly. So I'm just growing up and doing my thing, and I got minimal consequence. I'm from a small town. My mother was born and raised, lived, died, and is buried in this small town. And I remember when we got our first street light, you know, when I was a kid, just small town. And I was born in 12 BC before cable. And, so it's just a good place. My dad immigrated from London after World War II, which is really kind of unique in Southern Illinois. And so everybody knew our family. And my parents were good people and good members of the community. And so I got away with a lot of stuff. I was the subject of coffee shop conversation. That's the bad news also. Everybody knows my parents. And so I couldn't do anything and get away with it. Everybody knew. Later I was in the paper for the wrong reasons, you know. And I wanted to be in the military. My dad was in the Royal Air Force. And after he left, actually, it's how he came to this country. It was in the U.S. Air Force, and I joined the Air Force on my 17th birthday. I was going to go see the world, save the world, get a chest full of medals, get a scar, nothing big, just nothing life-threatening. I just wanted something that looked like it might be life-threatening, because chicks dig scars and medals. And I'm going to get the girl. Life's going to be wonderful. And I volunteered to go anywhere in the world. And they sent me to Omaha, Nebraska. And God, I was pissed. So I only knew one thing about Omaha, and that was I didn't want to go there. And I got here with a firm resolve to forget women and forget drinking, because every time I got in trouble, one or the other was involved. Always drinking. Once in a while, I'd meet someone with low enough standards. And do you ever wake up just out of one hell of a Saturday night, and you look over and you realize that you're the lower companion? That's pretty much the late 80s for me. But so I got here, and I got here on a Wednesday, and Friday night they had a party. They had two kegs of beer and a trash barrel, a 40-gallon trash barrel of purple stuff that tasted sweet and hit hard. Yeah. So I mean, I'm working with the big boys. I was 18 in a few months. I turned 18 the week after I got out of basic training, had a 6.5 month training school, and then I'm here. So I'm 18 and some change, and I'm running with big guys. I get to play with weapons. They're teaching me all kinds of nifty stuff. I'm working on a $1 billion jet. I'm doing all this cool stuff, and we get to party hard, and nobody messes with us because it's dangerous work. And so if you work hard and work dangerous, you get to play hard and dangerous. And I found my lane, you know. A couple days later, I met a gal, my first true love, whose name I just can't remember. But she kept coming back, and that's pretty much the requirement. I'm a kind of guy that's had a lot of first dates, you know. So I'm working hard. I love to work because it's my identity, right? I feel like a man among men. I'm working on a big airplane, and I got volunteered to be in a group to work on. It backs up the 89th group out of Andrews in Maryland. So we shadow the president and vice president and joint chiefs and those kind of people, SecDef. So I'm in that unit because I was a kid. And therefore I didn't realize my mortality. I'm also expendable and I'm unattached. So I'm the perfect candidate for that. So I'm on the alert teams. I'm going all over the world, with or without notice. I never know what my schedule is. I just kind of go places and do things. And when I had a lot of ego wrapped up in that. So I'm working this thing in my unit, you know, you do what you're formally trained in and you get trained on everything else. So I can start engines on a 747. I know how to. I can actually land it if it helps me a little bit, which it can. I can taxi it. I can do all kinds of different things. It's amazing. And I'm 18 years old. Too bad I couldn't tell anybody about it. But my life starts to unravel. In spite of all that stuff, I got a very high level security clearance, and I'm starting to get in trouble at work because I can't not drink. Sorry, I got an Apple Watch, and I don't really know what it does yet. I wanted one. I don't know why. So after I bought it, I told one of my friends, he said, why'd you get an Apple Watch? And I said, well, I'm getting older, and I look like a lowercase b or a lowercase d, depending on which way I turn, and I need to get off my butt and, you know, move and stuff. And he said, a watch is not going to get you off your butt. It is cool. I think it's, you know. Anyway, what were we talking about? So I'm in the military and flying around, and I just can't get it together, right? I had it together, I mean, for like 3 days. But then they had the kegs and the jungle juice and, And everybody else seems to be able to keep it together, and I can't. So, I mean, I'm showing up drunk, and I'm. It's hard to fix planes when you're drunk, and it's. I'm drinking vodka because I think he can't smell it. They can, especially when you start to sweat it out. And I'm just, you know, I'm getting by. The only reason I didn't get kicked out, they were in the process, and I got saved from on high, because there were literally a handful of people on the planet with my security clearance and my skill set. And Kuwait was about to happen, and we knew it. So that's the only reason I didn't get kicked out. I always thought, well, I never got fired from a job, and I'm, you know, am I really an alcoholic? And I didn't get fired from a job because I was in the right place at the right time, you know. So I got a DUI one night, and I tested 2.5 times the limit, and just over. A couple hours later, and I passed the field sobriety test. I mean, I was drunk all the time. That's how you get better at drunk driving, just practice. And here I was shocked. I'd been arrested before, and I'd been picked up before, and I'd never had any charges that stuck because I paid lawyers well, and everybody knew my parents. But in Omaha, they don't care who your small-town parents are from Illinois, and so they threw my butt in jail. And if you've never been to jail, if you're skinny, and I was skinny because I was living on, like, beer and vodka and bar pretzels. So if you need, like, a belt to hold your pants up, and they take it from you so you don't hang yourself with it. And they take your shoestrings. And it's really hard to try to look cool in big boy jail, shuffling and holding your pants up with one hand. I did my best. But just trying to, it's almost like the Trump dance, but if you've got Tourette's, because you just kind of shuffle, but you try to keep upright and look cool. And so they kept, I was in there for a little bit until I could get bailed out and get my truck out of impound. And, you know, once again, my life's just falling apart. And I'm trying everything I can think of. I knew I was an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic when I was 15. I was watching cartoons one Saturday morning, getting second drunk, which is when you're really hungover and dehydrated, you get a large cup of cold water and you slam it down, and then you got to chew back the vomit. You got to not throw up and hold it in there, and then you rapidly hydrate and you get a little buzz, second drunk. It's this way to stretch your budget when you're young. So I'm enjoying second drunk. I'm watching cartoons, and this PSA came on. Treatment centers were big in the 80s, and there was young people on there acting out the way I lived. And then they went to treatment, and they were, you know, and right away I identified. They said they were alcoholics, and, you know, and I was like, wow, that's it, I'm an alcoholic. But the other thing about me is I'm a genius at standardized tests. I'm really good at those things, deductive reasoning, and so... They think that I have a really high IQ, which basically means I can figure this out. So I didn't talk to anybody about my alcoholism. I just figured it out. I went to the library and I read books and all kinds of stuff. We didn't have the interweb on the line and stuff like that. We just had to read books. And I got all kinds of books and I tried to figure it all out. And I went to church extra. I stopped drinking the church wine. I kept taking the money just in case. It wasn't working out. I just couldn't figure it out. And then I thought the Air Force would clean me up. My second week at my training base, after basic training, I got busted being drunk on duty. That was that. I got arrested three times while I was in my training, but it was the training base. It's not there anymore, but it was in Northern Illinois. And so I could drive home on the weekends. I remember two highlights from that 6 month stretch. One, I was I came out of a blackout with two of my buddies saying, "Come on, man, we got to get the hell out of here," at the bowling alley on the base. And there's a pinball machine tipped over. Apparently, something happened that I didn't like, and I just tipped the machine over. And I never got caught for that. The other thing was. I came out of a blackout and some jack wagon buzzed me on the freeway. I had to go. I mean, been drinking all afternoon, and you know, I got a 40 ounce between my legs, and I'm driving home on the freeway, and I got to stop over and relieve myself on the shoulder of the road. As I turned to get in my car to chase this guy down and give him a stern talking to, I realized I was in the fast lane, not the shoulder. And I was taking a whiz on the slow lane is what I was doing. Thank God he was paying attention. But those are the only two things I remember from that time. That's how my drinking went. That's how my life went. And I had all these great opportunities, you know, oh, wow, I got this great job. Now, you know, I'm going to be a hero. And I got this. Nothing ever worked out. So I got this DUI, and they offered me, they called it the diversion program. They'd put me on probation, and my insurance wouldn't go up. They wouldn't tell the base. They actually changed the date on my ticket so it wouldn't be in the paper, so that Social Actions, which is the military Al-Anons, no offense, they, we'll talk about Al-Anon in a minute. They're just the bad people, right, that are looking to get you and get you in trouble, and so they never found it. Nobody found it. So I didn't get in trouble at the base, and then until they started to do background investigations for my clearance, my father called me and said, "You need to go into your boss, to your chief, and tell him everything, and you need to go right now." I was actually half drunk because it was 10 in the morning, and why wouldn't you be? And I had to get myself into the base right away. I discovered later my dad worked in the intelligence community. That's how he knew. He always knew everything. And he knew that they had, I mean, they got everything. This was a high-level clearance. They know everything. And so I fessed up, and I wound up not getting in trouble for that. because of the nature of what I did. And, you know, I just, what I've learned in AA is that doesn't make me special. It's just God's got purpose in everything. God wastes nothing. God wastes nothing. As much as I tried to waste my life chasing what I thought would help my disease, God wasted nothing. God wouldn't let my life be wasted. And I've come to believe that. I've lost some friends in AA. I've got some good friends that killed themselves with 20 years of sobriety. And some friends of mine that just never made it in the first place. And there's purpose in that too. I'm watching my younger brother die of alcoholism, and I have been for 25 years. And there's purpose in that. And I can prove God wastes nothing. Anybody seen that The Martian movie with what's that guy? Is it the Jason Bourne guy? Yeah, there you go. The guy's, right? It's so this guy's abandoned on Mars, and he's got to grow taters or something, or he's going to die because he's already ate all the rations. And so he goes and, you know, opens the bags of astronaut poop to use as fertilizer, right? That's waste. And it grows things. Nothing's wasted, not even waste. Which is good, because I was sure a waste when I got here. So I got probation. I went to AA. I got sentenced to meetings. They gave me a book. They gave me this book, actually. This is my first book. I didn't understand any of it. I started to read it, but it was really scary because this book talked about stuff that was in my secret place that I'm never going to tell anybody. And there were guys there. I mean, there was one guy. You know, there were some guys there were some World War II vets in there. And just everybody was old. The youngest person was like 35. It was disgusting. And I'm 19 at the time, and this is what my life's become. But I don't want to go to jail. I know enough. I'm honest enough to know that I'm going to be popular in jail for all the wrong reasons. And so I don't see somebody out there has some experience with jail. And I don't want to lose my job, and I'm just hanging on by a thread, so I'm just going to these meetings. And some guy wanted to be my sponsor, and I whatever, and I'm going to meetings and drinking and going to meetings. And I did that for many, many months. And what I learned there, what happened to me eventually is I got to where it talks about in the book where I couldn't imagine my life with or without alcohol, and I know a loneliness such as few men do. When you're drinking and going to AA meetings, you don't belong in AA. You're not really all the way in. You're a hanger-on. And when you're at the party but you go to those meetings, even if you're just going to get your card signed and not go to jail, you're not a partier. You don't belong. You're just a hanger-on. And so I'm just like, you know, I'm a dingleberry of life in every area. It's just not happening. And I in 1989, in the summer, I came out of a blackout, and I had my shotgun in my mouth. And I had the hammer back. It was a single shot. I had the hammer back. I was trying to put the hammer back. I had my toe on the trigger. And I went to get put my toe on the hammer to pull it back. And my brain said, well, what if your foot slips and it accidentally goes off? So I pulled the gun out of my mouth to get it cocked right. I mean, this is my thinking. My sick thinking actually saved my life that night. Because I call it the chicken gene kicked in, and I was like, you know, I mean, I've been drinking, maybe I just, I don't know, and maybe it could hurt. I don't have tattoos. I'm a veteran, and I'm the only person in my family that doesn't have tattoos above the age of 12, because they cost money and I'm cheap and they probably hurt, and I'm a delicate flower. So that saved my life. I came out of a blackout again in July, crawling around my apartment looking for my shotgun. And I realized I'd hocked it for beer money. And I spent, in the military, you get paid on the 1st and the 15th, and I did the next couple pay periods. I'm trying to scrounge money to get my shotgun out of hock. I don't know why. The first time I paid my bills, I don't know why. Who cares? I'm going to be dead in a little while. But I paid my bills, and then I didn't have enough money. The next time, I didn't pay my bills, so I would have some money, but then I had more money than I needed to get the shotgun out of hock. And if you're a real alcoholic like I am, you never kill yourself if you've got some beer money. So I took my money and I went to go drink. And if you're a real alcoholic, like me, what happens is you overshoot the mark and you drink the shotgun money. And so I drank the shotgun money. And I'm in between paychecks, and I just can't make it to the next check. So being a tough guy, I drove back to Illinois to mommy, and I showed up on a Thursday night, and they weren't home. So I went to get a few drinks. I didn't even unload my truck. I just went to get a few drinks. And then I came out of a blackout Sunday morning, and I'm on the floor and in the front room of my parents' house, and my little brother's just disgusted with me, just looks at me, and he walks away. And he was in high school at the time, and my mother, my sister was gone by then. She was married and gone, and thank God. And my mother was crying. My dad had run a detox center for a year and a half, and he knew exactly what he was dealing with. And he got me up and cleaned me up and said, I got your truck loaded with the rest of your stuff. I've got your gas tank full, and there's $20 on the dash to get you enough gas to get all the way back to Omaha. So don't drink it. There'll be no more money, and if you can't come back to this house sober, you can't come back. And we both knew what that meant. We both knew that meant I wasn't coming back. And so I left. The next thing I remember was the Monday night meeting in Bellevue, because I had to get my stupid card signed by one of you stupid people. I was going to go to stupid jail and be really popular. That's it. That's my motivation. Because now I'm a man without a home. I'm getting evicted from my apartment. They're repossessing my truck. They're probably going to kick me out this time. I got nothing. I got nowhere. I don't know. So I showed up at the meeting, and after the meeting, we're in line to thank the speaker. And a guy I hated, just hated him, Jake. Jake was an ass. I hated Jake. In inventory, I learned I hated Jake because Jake laughed. And Jake laughed big. Jake was like you guys. This is fun. And he laughed the laugh of a free man. I learned in inventory I hated Jake because Jake was free, and I wanted to be free, and I couldn't be free, which means Jake should die.
We like logic.
Preferably with fire, right? So I hated Jake, and Jake came up to me, and he says, "Hey, you got a sponsor yet?" And I said, "No, I don't have a sponsor." And he said, "Well, you got one now. Go down to the coffee shop. I'll be there in 10 minutes. And I'm like ready. I'm ready to tell him to screw off. And what comes out of my mouth is, "Yes, sir." And which was confusing. And I'm just like, I took a step to go. It's like I'm not drunk. I'm like, I'm straight, you know. And and he grabs my shoulder and he says, "Thank the speaker first, dummy." And I'm like, "Oh, come on, we're going now." Now Jake's twice my size. But you got to have high hopes, right? And I'll get a shot in. I ain't afraid. And I turn around to throw a punch at this guy and hear myself say, "Yes, sir." And I'm baffled, just baffled. And so I wind up at the coffee shop, and Jake says, he told me, it was just beautiful. And Jake knew I hated him. It's impossible to not know, right? I wasn't exactly subtle. And Jake said, "Look, pal, you're not a bad man, you're a sick man. You have a disease. You're me. You're me." And I was really offended by the "I'm him" bit. But I got a little hope. Just a touch of hope. I went to the meeting I'm going to not go to jail this week. That's why I went. And I got a little hope from a guy I hate, and he said, "I want you to call me every day for 30 days, and we're gonna go to a meeting every day for 30 days, and we're gonna read this book, and we're, you know, all this stuff." And I'm like, "Okay." He said, "You're gonna call me at 5 a.m. because I got to be at work at 5:30." And he was a cop, a sky cop at the base, and he asked if I had any questions, and I said, "Yeah, you said call every day for 30 days." Usually it's 90 and 90 meetings, and, you know, you said 30. why is that? And I'm thinking Jake is going to say, you know, you've been around for almost a year. And, you know, you're a really smart guy. And so that's probably sufficient. And what Jake said was, look, the reason I'm the only one here is because no one else wants to waste their time on you. You're probably not going to last the week. Let's just try to call me when you get home tonight. And I was crushed, just crushed. And so I drug my skinny butt to my crappy apartment that had no furniture and an oil heater in the middle of the room. It was just terrible. And I called Jake to let him know I was home. And Jake said, go dump the booze. And I said, what? And he said, go dump your booze. And I said, okay, I'll call you at 5 in the morning. And he says, oh, hold on, slick. I'll wait by the phone. So Jake's got trust issues. clearly. So I go dump my booze, and I come back to the phone, and Jake says, now go dump the last one. And I swore and went and dumped the last one. And I came back to the phone. I said, how did you know? And he said, I did the same thing. And I had a little more hope. Actually, step two happened right then and there. I hadn't even considered steps, right? A little bit of step two happened right then and there. I knew I was an alcoholic. Yes, sir, came out of my mouth because somewhere in here, I know my life's unmanageable. I got nothing. I'm never going to tell anybody else I don't know. But really, for the first time in a long time, I knew I didn't know. I don't know. And now this guy, I start to believe. I'm starting to believe maybe. And the next 3 months were a blur. I mean, I had a truck, and we would help people move. And I think that half the people in our home group moved just so I'd have something to do on Saturday morning. Holy crap. I even started to get a little bit of muscle. And, you know, we're moving people and going to meetings and going to coffee and all these things. And they'd always get me to coffee because they'd offer to buy because I didn't have any money. And I'm glad that there weren't child predators in the small town I was from. If you offer me anything, I'll get in the van. I don't care. I'm like, yeah, free what? Never mind. Let's go. What happened was I fired Jake in the first 40 days-ish I was sober because I met a girl. Yeah. Yeah, I called her to date Susie. We got past date number one, and so she was the one. And Jake and I, my truck needed tires and brakes, and that was $800. And I didn't have $800, so my solution was buy a $10,000 car, and made sense to me. Jake wouldn't let me have the car or the girl, so I fired him, and I got another sponsor. And he said, "Well, you know more about money than me. I mean, I've been sober a long time, and I'm trying to, I don't think I'll ever retire. We'll talk about the girl." I'm like, okay. So he was my sponsor. And then, and then later he would let me have the girl. So I changed again. And I don't recommend that. I didn't do it right in the beginning. But I was cleaning my apartment. It was right before I fired Jake. I was cleaning my apartment because that was one of the things I had to do. And I came across my shotgun shells. And I realized I hadn't thought about my shotgun in 2 months. And it had been a decade since I hadn't thought about my shotgun for 2 months. Step two, right? Holy crap, this is going to work. And at that point, I knew I was never going to drink again. I maintain a day at a time, but I'm just... I might kill myself, and probably three or four of you first, and do the rest of the home group a favor, but I'm never going to drink again. Never going to drink again. And, that's where I was, right? So I'm in. I'm still not really studying the book. I'm not comprehending a lot. I mean, I'm just not. My brain was fuzzy for a long time. But I'm going to meetings and doing the deal, you know, they said cute things like there's a slip behind every skirt. I'm like, whatever. Avoid the girls and all that stuff. Clearly, they didn't understand the depth of my loneliness. And, these guys, they were old. and ugly and old. And I'm a cutish young man. I need companionship. And so I chased newcomer girls. And I figured, hey, if they're willing to be caught, you know, I mean it. And I couldn't understand why none of the ladies in the group liked me. And they hid their sponsees from me. But I caught a gal, and she was crazy and cute, just my type. And she liked to make pasta. She liked to have sex. She liked to hang out. I mean, it was just wonderful. And but the only problem was she kept drinking. She just couldn't stay sober more than a week or two. Did I mention she was cute and pasta and sex and stuff? Okay, so we can overlook a little bit of a flaw. I mean, it's love and tolerance is our code. And so I, but then one time she went to get drunk and I almost went with her. And it scared the hell out of me. We skipped the meeting Friday night because she made us dinner. And anytime she made dinner on Friday night, I knew what was happening later Friday night. And I was going to stick around for the dessert. I wasn't going to waste my time driving to the meeting before I got dessert. And she started drinking, and I almost drank. And it scared the hell out of me. And I called my friend Terry, sponsor number two that I'd fired. Terry was one of the people, there were a handful of men as I'm in and out of AA, in and out of AA. And this, I think, is a really important part of working with others. They didn't treat me like the loser that we all knew I was. I was just an AA turd. I'm just hanging around, stinking up the place. I ain't staying around. And nobody would waste their time on me. But there were a handful of guys that did. Again and again and again. And they didn't treat me. Every time I'd come in, girls, they would hide their sponsees. And people would be like, good to see you again, you know. But these guys would be like, John, good to see you. Come on, man, you know. And I was welcome. I wasn't the pariah I knew I was. And I had a seat. And those men saved my life. They saved my life. Because it was okay to come back. And I think it's important that we do that. That people know it's okay to come back. It's not okay to go drink, but it's okay to come back. So when I called Terry and said, he says, hey, what's going on, champ? Missed you at the meeting. And I said, well, and I told him what happened. Terry didn't say, told you so, dummy. None of that crap. He said, I'm glad you called. We're at the Village Inn having pie and coffee. I'm buying. You coming? I'll be right there. And these old guys stayed way past their bedtime. I know that now. And and we had coffee and pie. And we didn't talk about little drunk Miss Slutty Pants. We didn't talk about the idiot who won't listen. We just hung out. We just had fellowship. No judgment, just fellowship. And once again, you saved my life in spite of me, right? That's really important. I've come to understand for me that there's an angle to the responsibility statement I never noticed, right? I always thought, well, I'm responsible anytime, anywhere, blah, blah, blah. I'll put my money in the basket. Yeah, I'll do setup because I've been sober a long time and it's just what we do, and right? I'm responsible to be a hand that someone's willing to reach out to. That's the responsibility in addition to the logistical things, yeah? I need to be available. I need to be approachable. I need to be present. That's what those guys were. They were available, they were approachable, and they were present. And they saved my life. 200 people in the meeting. 6 of them were available and approachable. And it's important that I do that. What I try to do today, and I'm not as successful as I'd like you to believe, but I rather than hang with my cronies or whatever, I try to walk the room and work the room as best I can. Because sometimes the newcomer in the room's got 36 years of sobriety. I met with the guys I sponsor, most of them. We do a book study at 8 o'clock Sunday mornings online. One of the longest sober guys I sponsor just had 31 years, and his previous sponsor left AA at 33. I don't know why. Exactly. And we've all had ebbs and flows, right, in what we're doing. But he's gone and we're not. And I want to be me. I don't want that. And so I got to do the work. And I wonder sometimes if I would have noticed my friend. You know, we just walk by. Hey, Jess, how you doing? I'm good, good. Yeah, we walk on by. If I would have just spent 2 more seconds, I don't know. And I try to remember that, and I try to be intentional about walking the room and working the room. And that may or may not help somebody else, but it's going to save me. One of my guys today, one of my out-of-towners said to one of the other out-of-town guys, they met an online meeting, and he says, why don't you come meet my sponsor? Come in this book study on Sunday mornings. And the guy's been sober almost 4 months now. And he said, I'm glad you made it. Since I met you, I worked with 3 or 4 new guys, and none of them has stayed sober. And I sponsor a guy with about 7 years in China, and he piped up and he said, yeah, but you're here, right? Who cares about those guys? They don't really matter. I mean, in the grand scheme of things. Personally, of course they do. We'll pray for them. But, you know, keep doing what you're doing. I got to get moving. So I sobered up. I got over the women thing. I got focused on AA. I got into the book. I got into the steps. I got into doing the work and leaving the girls alone. I got involved in service work. And I wound up, one of my dear friends sobered up a few months after me, and our spouses sobered up the next year, and which was really cute. And but she was my first female friend in AA, and that was really cool. I didn't know, and we didn't know at the time. We'd never talk about it with each other, but now we were each other's first friend of the opposite sex, and the first person of the opposite sex we were friends with, like with clothes on and stuff. And it's just cool. It's just cool. I just love her dearly, and she just had 36 years. Got her chip Tuesday night. What an honor to get that. My world doubled in size, because girls weren't potential sex toys. They were people. And so my world literally doubled in size. It's amazing. I'm on the playing in sand volleyball before my knees got bad, and in the AA bowling league, and not chasing girls mostly. I got a little bit of a reprieve. My sponsor said I could look around. I took that to mean as long as I'm not technically legally stalking, we're okay. And so I was at a coffee one night, not stalking a gal. I was just being seen. You got to be seen to be chosen. Peggy Martin and one of her minions approached me and said, hey, you're single, right? And you can't tell Peggy that you're not stalking a gal. Because if you tell Peggy Martin you're not stalking a gal, she'll tell your sponsor you're not stalking a gal. And then you definitely have to not stalk a gal. And so I said, well, yeah, but I mean, Peggy, I'm trying to perfect and enlarge my spiritual condition and practice love and tolerance of others. And you know, and she's like, yeah, okay, cutie, let's, you should ask Teresa out. Talk to your sponsor about that, which means I have to talk to my sponsor about that because her husband, Dick, sponsors my sponsor. And so I talked to my sponsor, and he said, kid, let me tell you how this works, right? We say don't date for a year. The reason we do that, okay, is because you're crazy as hell, and sick attracts sick. I mean, Jesus, do you want to hang out with you? Be honest. I've heard your fifth step. I'm like, okay. I can't. Right, I can't. I got nothing here. I'm like, well, okay. He says, now these girls, right, the book calls them fallen women. And I'm like, hey, can I hear it for fallen women, right? I love it. And you're my type, baby. And these fallen women come in, and they start to get, you know, spiritually fit and dateable. And their sponsor brings them to the Foxhall group and says, sweetheart, there's 500 people in here. Half of them are men. Half of them are available. What do you think's a good batting order? And she probably said, you know, John Evans is sort of cute. Now, I didn't tell my sponsor this, but immediately every fiber of my being went, hell yeah, she did, right? And because I'm a catch, I think. And So I said, well, I, yeah, I'm, you know, and he says, look, you don't got it. Just take her on one date, take her to a movie, take her to dinner, take her to the meeting Saturday night, you know, bring her home, walk her to the door, shake her hand as with as long of a reach as you can muster, and then call me when you get home and you're single. And I'm like, okay. And he says, well, you're going to treat her like a gentleman. I'll teach you how. And so we did. We did just that. We had an AA first date. She was my friend Teresa. We were on the sand volleyball team and the bowling team, and we were part of this group of people that would go out to coffee and go to dances and do all these things. And I didn't think anything of it, you know. I that's not what I was. She wasn't a sex toy with feet. She was a person. And so I did just what he said. And Friday was our 33rd wedding anniversary, which is cool, right? The reason for the success, I get asked a lot by guys, what's the trick? And I said, you know what? Page 69 of the book, it's not lost on me that page 69 talks about sex. Is that not funny as hell? It comes, but read that sometime, right? And to the best of your ability, have sex out of your mind. Think relationship. Think about the guy or gal you work for. Think about the person who needs your lane on the freeway. Think about anyone you have any kind of relationship with and read through that once. Yeah? It gets to the end of it and it says, it really comes down to one thing. Was it selfish or not? Well, okay, but I mean, she was wearing this. Was it selfish or not? Well, the guy was like not all the way ahead of me and wanted my lane. Was it selfish or not? Really very simple. Even a guy like me can understand it. And so I got a sponsor. She's got a sponsor. It's not each other. We're both doing what we do in AA, right, to perfect and enlarge our spiritual condition, to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. We're doing what we got to do. We go to meetings together, but we're not at meetings together. You know what I mean? And we just do AA. We're doing the same thing we've always done. And it's working. Today, I can tell you, she's my favorite person to be with. I miss her. She sent me a text this morning. I can't wait to get home to be with her. I don't really care what we're going to. It doesn't matter where we're going or what we're doing, you know? And that's a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a gift of getting me out of the way so that I can see reality. I thought a sex toy with feet would just make my day. I'm like, wow, I can have any flavor, anytime, but yeah, give me some of that. And you'll cook? Okay. And if they pay me enough, and if they do this, as all this outside stuff, it turns out when I get me out of the way, then God's will comes in, and life is what it's supposed to be. I can't tell you I've got what I want, but I want what I have. And I've never felt that way in my life. Never. I spent my whole life trying to distract myself from the ism. Sex, work, money, whatever. And all it was a distraction. And it only lasts so long. I'm an alcoholic, not because of the way I drink. If I have a drinking problem, I got a sober solution. Abstinence, right? Talks about that in the doctor's opinion. Just don't drink. Great, thanks, doc. Problem is, the further removed I am from a drink, the crazier I get. It's like I got a spring in my head and my chest and my gut. I'm just like, and I got it. Drinking is the only thing that does it. Now the allergy kicks in when I have a drink, the phenomenon of craving, right? I go off on a spree. This happens again and again and again, unless the doc says I have an entire psychic change. We call that the biggest promise in our program. I think it is. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. It's the single biggest promise in our program for me. In the 12 and 12, I love this part, in the 12 and 12 essay on step 12, it talks about spiritual awakening. I would encourage you to read the first few pages of that. One thing says, I've become able to do, feel, and believe that which I could not do before on my own strength and resources. I've been set on a path that tells me I'm really going somewhere. Life's not a dead end. I hope I never forget when life was a dead end. Losing that memory will kill me. Life's not a dead end. It's not something to be endured or mastered. I don't know about you, but really what I've been doing my whole life is either enduring it or mastering it. What I get out of Alcoholics Anonymous is the ability to just live it. That's what takes me out of the circumstance. The circumstance doesn't really matter when I'm in spiritual condition because I'm not enduring it and I'm not trying to master it. I'm just living it. Teresa's got cancer. That sucks. Okay, what do we do? What's next? We found out a few years ago she had cancer, and she asked me what I would do if she died. And I said, we're on our way to Nashville, Tennessee for a thing, and we got several hours in the car yet. And she's just like, no, really, what do you think you would do? And I said, well, I'd bury you within 3 days because you'd start to smell funny. And then I would go all over town getting as much sympathy sex as I can get until I break a hip or catch an STD. And I don't know, we'll figure it out from there. And she told me I was a disgusting pig, and I agreed with her. And we just live in the moment. I sponsor a guy whose wife had cancer, much worse than my wife's, and she's doing good. She's on the tail end, and things are going to be okay. But he called me a few weeks into that deal and said, we've always had a decent marriage, but my marriage has never been so good. I don't understand it. And I said, you know, all relationships end in death or divorce. The guy I worked for in 1996, that ended in divorce. I took a different job, right? My good friend Pete, who I called down the hall when my dad was in a hospital room waiting to die, and the wave of despair hit me out of nowhere. I stepped out of the hall and I hit talk, talk. And the last person I talked to on the phone was my friend Pete, right? Pete died of COVID right before Thanksgiving in 2020, and that relationship ended. I don't have time to worry about when the next relationship's going to end, right? I just enjoy the day, enjoy the moment, because one day somebody's going to die, or somebody, one of us is going to decide the relationship's done. So just enjoy the moment. That's the idea of a day at a time. I'd like to tell you I've known these things because I'm a wise Yoda, and I've known these things for decades. A lot of this stuff I've just kind of come to understand this way in the last 5 years. About 5 years ago, let me back up a little bit. In 2003, well, my wife and I got married, right? And you do what you do. You get a house and get an Alla dog and a couple of Alla kids. And then we got an Alla church and an Alla van and living the life. Whee, look at us. We're in AA. And in 2003, her dad died suddenly in the summer. And my mother died after a prolonged illness in the fall. And it crushed us. You don't know what to do. But you knew what to do. I've learned in AA, whatever the circumstance, good, bad, or indifferent, that what I got to do is lean into Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything in my disease tells me I got to run away. I got to get away. What I got to do is lean into the program, because here's where the solution is. Here's where the connection is. I can't handle life. My life is unmanageable by me, but everything's okay with us, right? So that's what I do. Some years later, our older son, we sent him to a private high school so he would straighten up, and there he majored in pharmaceuticals, distribution, delivery, research and development. Yeah, he was a very good, and he spent some time in juvie, and we got calls a couple times on Friday nights that they picked him up, and they didn't know if he was going to make it, and it was terrifying. Some months later, we had to ask him to leave our home. We have a sober home. We have another child there. And he knew, my sponsor taught me to teach my kids choices and consequences. The best thing I can do for my kids, the men I sponsor, the newcomer in the room, is let them know they have a choice. I never knew. I never had a choice. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I get a choice. My disease today tells me, oh, you're sober 36 years. You sponsor a bunch of guys. You speak at conferences and stuff. You're like, you got this, or you screwed up again? You've been sober how long and you screwed up? You don't want to talk to your sponsor about that. What'll he think? That's the ism. That's the sick thinking, yeah? I got to be in. In is where the solution's at. And so we didn't know what to do with that. And I didn't like Al-Anon, but fortunately my sponsor caught me smoking cigars with my idiot friends out in the parking lot during the Al-Anon speaker one time at a conference. And he said, the next time I catch you in doing that, I'm just going to ask you who your sponsor is, because it won't be me. And the next conference that came in town, I had to sit next to my sponsor, like a freaking 2-year-old, and listen to every stupid Al-Anon speaker that they invited that year. I love you. But let me tell you what happened when we had to invite our son to leave. Al-Anon, I'd never been to an Al-Anon meeting. My wife went. My sponsor said if I complained one more time, he'd make me go. But a couple of men in Al-Anon attached themselves to me. Called me, checked on me, walked with us, right? Ladies in Al-Anon. Al-Anon surrounded us and walked with us. Thank you. Thank you. We didn't ask for it. I couldn't have. You're the evil opposition. How wrong I was. Thank God for my sponsor straightening me out. When you get a chance to hear an Al-Anon talk, grab Mary's talk, get it, listen to it. It was a good, solid talk. That's what we're here for. We're here to recover. They've got a perspective I don't have. I just don't have it. And they know how to let go and do those things. My life in recovery has been a series of events like that. About 5 years ago, I found myself in a corner. And I'm a guy that's in the middle of AA. I'm in the book. I'm a student of the traditions. I've done step studies and tradition studies. I've led book studies. I mean, all that stuff. I sponsor guys. I do all these things. I'm in the middle, right? Out here. But I do this, I get up, I go here, I do this, and the rut's good until it's a rut. And I had spiritually atrophied in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was shocked. I wound up changing most of my meetings. I changed sponsors after 20 years. I do not take that lightly. My sponsor and I had come to an impasse on a couple of things, nothing major, you know, and we're friends now. Everything's back, you know, which is good. But I'm back in the middle. What changed, the catalyst for getting through that was getting back in the book, studying the literature with other men. That's when we started that study. Since then, we started a men's retreat. That's about 20 years coming, but I was afraid. What would people think of me? I'm a newcomer in my home group, right? Who's he think he is? You know, who cares, man? Do it. I think it's wonderful, right? But what's going on this weekend. I think it's amazing. I think you should keep doing it. I think it's a shame there's not 100 more people in here this morning, because I'm a really cute-ish guy.
I tried to tell him.
Ish? Ish. Come on now. This is where the solution is. This is where the solution is. I still don't understand what some of the stuff that I got to do has to do with my recovery. I still don't want to do half of the stuff that I got to do half of the time. But it's not lost on me. Every time I'm with you, I see a living, walking, talking, breathing example, proof that if I do this, I get this. If I do the recipe, I get the spiritual awakening. My old sponsor, Jim Beam, true story, that was his name. He liked to talk about cake. I'm going to tell you the cake story. I'm going to shut up. This deal is like, no, I'm not. I'm not going to tell you the cake story. If you do the recipe, you get the result. I want to tell you about my father. My father was the single biggest relationship in my life. My dad was the only person that never left me. My mom didn't want to, but she couldn't stomach it, and she couldn't watch the show anymore. My dad's the only person that stayed with me. And in 2010, we found my dad had a heart attack. They didn't know if he was going to live through the night. I was in the IT business at the time. I was making more money than a guy like me should ever make. But I had money in the bank because I'm living below my means. So we tracked down my drunken brother, and two last-minute first-class tickets were all we could get, and I had the money. I mean, spent $6,000, and we flew to Charleston, where he had moved. And he lived through the night and had open-heart surgery and all that stuff. And in the recovery process, they found he had cancer, and my dad did two tours in Vietnam, and he had cancer everywhere. And the last months he was alive, he was in a care facility, just in a bed, kind of waiting to die, and I would go there and be with him. And it was an honor to get to do that. I couldn't always be there for people. I had the money and the time. I didn't know what to do or when to go down there. And my sponsor said, you'll know. Ask God and you'll know. I'm not a clubhouse guy. I don't knock them. I'm just, meetings are meetings, right? Whatever works. But I'm not, there's clubhouses in Omaha. I don't go to them. I go to my meetings. But in North Charleston, South Carolina, at 8 o'clock every night, 7 nights a week, there's a meeting in a clubhouse. And it was the one consistent thing I could have when I was down there. And so I would go to this clubhouse meeting. And they were there. And they got my number. And they called me. And they remembered me. And they walked with me through that. I wasn't alone. One of the hallmarks of alcoholism, I think, is abject loneliness. Mm-hmm. And I can be alone today in the middle of my home group if I'm not doing the deal. And so I went there and walked the room and worked the room. And people said, how are you? And I said, you know what? I'm down here because my dad's dying. And they said, sit down and have a cup of coffee, right? I think there might have been one person with about as much time as I had. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Right? We walk together through this thing. The last thing either of my parents asked me before they died was to take care of my brother because he was a drunk and they had sent him to Omaha saying, those people helped your brother. Maybe they can help you. And I got to tell both of them, I can't, that's not what AA does. But I'll always take his call. And I won't get in the way of his consequences, but I'll always take his call and I'll always be happy to bring him to a meeting. And that was good enough. I was a guy that was in the paper for the wrong reasons. When my mom died, we found, I was on the dean's list in college. I went to college eventually on the side and I got straight A's, had 3 B's and all A's, and I'm still praying for a couple people, but my mom would send that information to the small town paper. And she kept clippings from the small town paper. She had a shoebox of them. My mother died proud of her loser son because of you. My father died, my parents both died with hope for their child because how you saved the life of their other child. That I didn't know I wanted that. I didn't think anything like that was possible. But that's the kind of life I've got today. Those are just a few of the many minor miracles that I've observed in my life and in yours in the time I've been here. The crazy thing is it continues to get better and better and better. The answer is this, and I'll shut up. The bottom line, this not having to endure or master this spiritual experience, it says later in the 12 and 12, this is a free gift. Free gift. Our way of making ready to receive the gift lies in the practice of the 12 steps. I don't have to get this. I don't have to earn forgiveness. I am forgiven. I learned that in step 5, yeah? How do I make myself ready to receive forgiveness? I forgive others. How do I do that? I take inventory. I learn about my resentments. I do, right? This seemingly innocuous work that has nothing to do with my real problem, lack of sex, lack of money for the rent, and they repossess my truck, right? Fixes the core problem. I work these steps into my life, and I make myself ready to receive this free gift that's always been there. That's what this is about. If you're new or you're not so new and you think this can't happen for you, I assure you it will. It's a guarantee. You go where we go and do what we do, you will get what we've got. If you're not convinced of that, I'll be down here. Grab me. We'll have a talk. We'll get you hooked up. And I would encourage you all to walk the room and work the room. And I hope to see you at the next event. Thank you again for having me. Is that too long?
No, sure.